This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Donald Trump's absolute disregard for scientific reality, whether it's the coronavirus or climate change, has been a signature of his presidency. His open contempt for putting on a mask was a threat from the first to the countless Americans who choose to emulate him. It endangered, in the end, the president's own life and the lives of everyone around him. Last week, just as Trump was leaving Walter Reed Hospital after a stay of 3 days, Dr. Anthony Fauci sat down for a conversation with The New Yorker's Michael Spector. Fauci is the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is a branch of the NIH, and he's really the most public voice in this country for medical reason. Michael is a longtime staff writer at The New Yorker, covering medicine and the sciences. They spoke on Monday.
As we are speaking, the president of the United States is scheduled to leave the hospital any minute, and he's going to go back to the White House. And I'm not going to ask you to comment on his strange regimen of drugs or how he's feeling. I know you're not his personal physician, and that's not your thing. But I do want to talk about public health, because this afternoon he tweeted, COVID, no big thing. Don't be afraid of it. And, you know, 210,000 Americans have died and 6-7 million have been infected. Is it fair to say no big thing? Don't be afraid of it?
Yeah, well, you know, Michael, that's been one of the things that have been sort of a bone of contention in communication of the seriousness of this. I mean, obviously, it's a very unusual pathogen that can have virtually no effect in the sense of 40%, 45% of people can be without symptoms. And then for those who have symptoms, the overwhelming majority of them are mild. But there are a group of individuals who fall into a certain subset or category, namely the elderly and those with underlying conditions at any age, who can have a severe outcome. So when you look at the now 210,000 people in the United States of America who've died, and you talk about the 7 million who've been infected and the 1 million who've died globally, I think anybody who's looking at this realistically has to say that this is a very serious disease that we need to reckon with.
The White House will now not do any contact tracing from the September 26 Rose Garden event to celebrate the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett. Are you comfortable commenting on that?
You know the answer to that, no. I'm not. I don't want to get into what the White House is or is not doing. That becomes non-productive and doesn't really help the messages that I'm trying to get across. Sorry, Michael.
Well, let me just, it was a try. But let me ask it in a slightly more general way. How can we stamp this thing out if we don't contact trace? How can we know who's infected and who isn't infected if we don't follow the people who are infected and see who they were in contact with? Is there a way other than contact tracing?
You know, we do need contact. Contact tracing is important. I mean, it's one of the many tools that we have to try and contain an outbreak. It is likely, we haven't proven it yet, but likely that an asymptomatic person during that gathering at the White House began the chain of transmission that obviously occurred within that group. So I must tell you, Michael, that in this situation that we're in, where infection comes to a great extent from people without symptoms, it becomes very difficult and problematic to do adequate contact tracing, even if you wanted to do adequate contact tracing. The community spread among people who are without symptoms make that very, very difficult.
We have a real problem in this country with people believing in vaccines. They are hesitant. I'm not even talking about the hardcore anti-vaccine activists, just people who are afraid. And what has gone on with the discussion of the vaccine until now has not made people more confident. They already say, to the tune of about 40%, that they won't take the vaccine. How do we get people back to the point where they think the things that will save their lives will actually save their lives?
You know, Michael, there's not going to be an easy answer to that. First of all, we need to be completely transparent and consistent in what we do. This is true for everyone out there. It becomes even more imperative to do that with minority communities, because traditionally and historically, minority communities have not been served well by the government and by society in general. And they don't trust authority for a number of reasons, many of which are really justified. So you've got to overcome that barrier. And that's what we try to do. We try to get community people who they trust to go into the community and try to get them to understand the importance for their own health, but also for the health of the community. It would be tragic if we do get a safe and effective vaccine, but they don't benefit from it because A, they refuse to get involved in the clinical trials, or B, once the clinical trials are over, they don't believe that the vaccine is safe and effective for them and they don't take it, when in fact they stand to benefit the most from a safe and effective vaccine.
When you describe this, it makes me wonder how short of a very effective vaccine, which even if we're lucky, it's not going to happen soon and it's not going to be distributed immediately, we are going to get out of this. It looks like we have a long way to go in this pandemic before we go to the movies. Are we ever going to go to the movies again?
Yes, we are, Michael, and I'll even buy you a ticket. We'll go together to alleviate your anxiety. You know, we will.
Okay.
So I get asked this question all the time. When are we going to get back to something that closely resembles or is in fact normal as we knew it? It is likely that we will know that we have a safe and effective vaccine by, let's say, November or December of this year. That I have cautious optimism that we will have a vaccine. We're already making doses, a lot of doses, tens and hundreds of millions of doses, to be ready first, at least in graded numbers, at the end of the year in November, December, and then as we get into January, February, March, April. By the time we get to April, we likely will have doses to be able to vaccinate anybody who needs to be vaccinated. But you need to have a highly effective vaccine, and you need to get a substantial proportion of the population vaccinated. So let's say we get a 70% effective vaccine, which I hope we will get, but only 60% of the people get vaccinated. There are going to be a lot of vulnerable people out there, which means that the vaccine will greatly help us to pull back a bit on the restrictions that we have now to maintain good public health. But it's not going to eliminate things like mask wearing and avoiding crowds and things like that. So I think we can approach normality. We may have theaters where you got to make sure that you don't have full capacity, that maybe you wear a mask at the theater. That may go on for months and months. I can't predict how long, but I don't think we're going to be back to normal until the end of 2021. And that's just, you know, a prediction. We may do better than that. I hope so, but I don't think so.
I want to switch a bit to the AIDS era. There was a guy who died this year who was very important to both of us. He called both of us murderers at different points in our life, but we ended up both being somewhat close to him. And I wanted to play just one little interaction between you and the person I'm talking about, for those who are out there, is Larry Kramer, who was a signature AIDS activist and a really remarkable person who was both difficult and thrilling at the same time. And I'd like to play an exchange. This is from the 90s when Tony and Larry were on a television talk show together.
we're not going to get the answer tomorrow. And the kinds of inroads that are made, as small as they are, science works in small building blocks of knowledge.
Oh, and Tony, stop it. Yes, the answer could come tomorrow. Why do you automatically take such a negative attitude? You're not going to get it. Let me finish. And it doesn't. It happens in big building blocks as well as little building blocks. It's all of this rhetoric of yours and everybody else in a bureaucracy. I want to say something about Tony Fauci, because I think the world must think I hate him or something, the way I'm going on tonight. I love Tony. Actually, I think I probably have a more complicated relationship with Tony than anybody in my entire life. He is a man, an ordinary man, who is being asked to play God, and he is being punished because he cannot be God. And that is a terrible situation to be in, to be the lightning rod for all of us.
True?
Yeah, to a certain extent, I wouldn't as bad. You know, Larry would be very theatrical and confrontative, but there was so much wisdom in his words. And to an extent, it was true, because I was put in a position that I was the face of the government and I was leading the biomedical research effort. And the biomedical research effort could not possibly have moved quickly enough to save so many of the people back then who you and I know and knew, some of whom were very close to me, who were infected and who died of AIDS before we had the life-saving drugs that we had now. And I was called upon to do this, what took years, to do it tomorrow. But these activists had certain things that they were confronting that I said to myself very clearly, it was unambiguous. I said, if I were in their shoes, I would be doing exactly what they were doing. In fact, maybe even more forcefully.
Did you honestly felt many years ago that that was the end of it, right? But it's gotten pretty difficult, hasn't it? On a personal level, what do you think that is?
I mean, the activists never threatened us in a serious way. They wanted to gain our attention. Their motivations were all pure, and we developed extraordinarily good relations with them. The threats that I would get back then of the people who were, I guess, the extremist far rights, were very upset that they felt I was expending a lot of time worrying about these gay guys, these queers, or whatever it is that they were, you know, calling them, because I was very empathetic to the gay community. And these were a minor group of people that I just blew off. And I mean, and their threats were nothing but silly things. The threats that we get now are real. I mean, threats on life, harassment of family, harassment of my wife, harassment of my children, that requires our needing security. But right now, I believe, Michael, it's a reflection of the extreme divisiveness in our society when a public health message becomes opposing political views. Everybody wants to get the country back to normal again. The enemy is not the public health mandates. The enemy is the virus. Let's get that clear. The enemy is the virus. But it seems that that's not the way things are rolling out here.
Anthony Fauci, the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He spoke with staff writer Michael Spector on the first day of the New Yorker Festival, which runs through October 11th. Michael is also the author of Fauci, a new autobiography published by Pushkin Industries.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.